Blog Talk Radio.
You know, just another few seconds here, Robert. It's not quite a...
Mm-hmm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this morning's podcast. It's our first podcast for the summer, and we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Robert Rand. He is the Director of Business Development at a leading, I guess, web hosting company, if I'm correct, here in the Chicagoland area. In fact, his exact title is the Director of Partnering Alliances. Excuse me on that. Robert, thank you for your time this morning. It's really, truly an honor to have you. I think you're the first guest we've had to talk about maybe more along the lines of web hosting and web hosting security, and especially on the e-commerce front. Thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Robert, let's go ahead and get started with your background. How did you get started? Tell us about your background. Like, how did you get started where you're at right now? Your background in cybersecurity and or security, like kind of like what led you to the road that you're at right now?
So as with tech, it's probably a little bit of a winding road. I started more heavily in the industry. I was the CTO of a digital agency for about a decade. We specialized in design development and digital marketing. And so we would build lots of websites, including lead generating, informational, corporate websites, lots of e-commerce websites. We help bring a lot of great brands into e-commerce. And alongside of that, my security expertise had to keep growing to advise people well and bring in the right tools and solutions and what have you. And I've continued forward past the acquisition of that agency to join the JetRails team, where I've been for about 2.5 years, overseeing partnerships and alliances, where I get to sort of help be the glue in a lot of ways between the web developers that our clients hire and the agencies and SIs that they work with, and the different providers that we partner with, great security companies and solutions like Cloudflare, Sicuri, SamSec, the list goes on and on, where at JetRails, we provide mission-critical web hosting. So rather than just provide the infrastructure, we really wrap around all of those layers that relate to speed and security and reliability and scalability and just overall, stability of the environment. And so as part of that, we have all of these different best-in-class, best-in-breed solutions that we're able to pair our clients up with and provide as more comprehensive one-stop-shop solution where we're helping to optimize and monitor and maintain from our network operations center, from our NOC. So I sit slightly on the less technical side of the team. I'm not the one out at data centers dealing with our hardware or on the front lines of support and onboardings and migrations and other things that we deal with as a team. But I live and breathe whatever it is that's going to be really impactful to these businesses and organizations that we support.
Okay. Now, would it be fair to state for clarity to our audience, you're not really like another web hosting provider, not like another GoDaddy or Namecheap, but you're a lot more upper echelon and much more focused in the area that you serve for the web hosting to your clients. Am I correct to say that?
That's a very fair statement, that the company started in the year 2000 as Ebound Host, which was a more traditional web hosting provider. And over the years, what the team realized was that, there was a lot of opportunity to stick with more of the basic shared hosting, the raw infrastructure, but the demand, what people really needed in market were more of the service layers, more of the maintenance and management and monitoring, more of the optimization, more of that expertise where these end users didn't have their own 24/7 mm-hmm. sysadmin, their own sysops team. They needed things to be able to sleep well at night, to be able to operate safely and efficiently, to be able to wow their users with speed or protect their businesses with various security. And so JetRail started as a product and then became the brand, became the face of the company. Same team, same offices, but sort of that rebranding to focus several years ago now on providing a service that is more targeted toward what I'll consider mid-market and enterprise, organizations that are already up and running that really need layers that relate to optimization and really this high-touch kind of support where it's proactive and, you know, they can't afford downtime. They can't afford latency. They can't afford security incidents. They're past all that. So typically we start with a fully managed dedicated server, whereas, you know, a lot of those, you know, GoDaddy style hosts, they'll offer, you know, very small shared environments where you're just getting a slice of resource along with lots of others on a single server. Where to us, we're all single tenant. Everyone's got their own dedicated resources, which from a security standpoint is really the only way we want to go.
Sure, sure. Now, without giving it obviously too much confidential information about your infrastructure, do you make use of the AWS or Microsoft Azure for the cloud, for like for your cloud backend, or do you have your own, you're totally independent and you have your own complete and entire infrastructure?
So we have our own infrastructure and we have a long history of that. And in many cases, that's going to be best bang for your buck. And so as an example, if an organization is domestic here in the United States and they have predictable traffic, and that might include spikes, but predictable. Let's say it's e-commerce and in Q4 they get a big boost in traffic, but they know what that looks like. We can put them on our bare metal and provide all of the additional layers that go with that, you know, the caching layers, the web application firewalling, intrusion detection systems, malware scanners, off-server backups, you know, the content delivery networks, everything that's going to go into that. And that's fantastic, and we monitor it and manage it from our NOC, from our network operations center. However, if they have a good reason or just their simple choices that they want to be in the cloud, we are an AWS partner organization, and we love working with AWS's infrastructure. It's where a lot of our larger clients go because we auto-scale there both horizontally and vertically. So not just adding CPU and RAM and what have you, but automatically being able to spin up more web nodes, more cloud servers on demand. And so for, you know, those the big organizations that we support, that's often crucial. So is for some of those international organizations that need us to be able to spin up in different regions of the world, our ability to do that with a partner like AWS. We really do the bulk of our cloud hosting with AWS. We've also partnered with DigitalOcean. But we've decided as a team that we don't want to be, as they say, jack of all trades and master of none. And so AWS is really the core for a lot of those larger accounts that we work with, as opposed to trying to really simultaneously bring the same quality and level of service for Azure, Google's cloud, and every other cloud out there.
Okay, excellent. Now, JetRails, are you focused primarily on the Chicago market, or is the world literally your oyster, given the virtual nature, you know, of this business?
I think that we have world domination in mind as a company. We are headquartered in Chicago, but our clients are anywhere and everywhere. Majority of our clients are in North America, but we support companies around the globe. So, you know, and our support is truly 24/7. So it's really just a question of what their need is. And our ability to service that need, and we really do try to focus most heavily there. So if they're on a platform like Magento or Drupal or WordPress, you know, we're a PHP-based platform that we're really highly experienced in supporting. That's fantastic. If they need more custom support with a PHP-based application, excellent. You know, there are certainly other hosting needs or other things that we don't work with Microsoft-based hosting. We don't have ASP.NET-based websites and things that we're helping to operate. So I think it has generally more to do with what their tech stack is, what their needs are, versus where they're located for us.
Yeah, excellent. Now, who is the customer base that you're trying to target? Is it like the SMBs, the Fortune 500, or perhaps a mixture of both, or really what's your sweet spot in that area?
So because we start with dedicated servers and such into the hundreds of dollars a month, we're typically not competing in the small business arena, you know, with coffee table startups, you know, startups out of people's garages, that sort of thing. You know, the local small business that just needs to host their small WordPress site that gets a few visits a day. That, you know, there are a lot of options for those sorts of things. We really shine when it comes to what we would consider more mid-market or enterprise, so organizations that are traditionally reaching toward, you know, into the millions in revenue, that sort of thing. They're more established, or at least they're on a trajectory for that, where it makes sense to invest a little bit more to get what they need more holistically and to get better results, to get better return on investment on their hosting. Folks that have gone from treating it as a commodity where they're looking for the absolute cheapest solution, and instead they're looking at quality and support. You know, our support team picks up the phone within 10 seconds, 24/7, and about 90% of the time the first person to pick up the phone is going to resolve whatever request or issue. The same with ticket responses, 15-minute response time, about 90% of the time first person to automatically be assigned a ticket is going to resolve it. So we cut out a lot of the kick-the-can stuff where you're waiting hours, days, or weeks for resolution or just not getting the help that you need with a lot of hosts that really focus on providing cookie-cutter prefab solutions to the masses with very, you know, basic frontline support. We really take a different approach to it and treat every incident, every issue as mission critical. We understand that, you know, majority of our users are e-commerce, and so that really fits in that's their business. You know, you think of it like a retail store that if the power goes out and they can't sell anything and they're paying their staff and they, you know, they have their marketing spend and they have everything else going and the site's not operating well, you know, whether it's brick and mortar or whether it's online, it's a problem. And so as that infrastructure provider, as providing that that foundation for their business, that's you know, crucial for us to be able to provide. No different than, you know, large organizations that have other types of websites or applications that they're running that have similar needs that they're just highly reliant on, and they can't afford to have problems or issues of any sort.
Okay. Let's not go into the heart of the show here. What's your connection to the e-commerce community?
So personally, from my agency days, I partnered with a lot of the biggest players in the e-commerce space in terms of the e-commerce software platforms and the companies that created add-ons and extensions and modules and plugins and other solutions, you know, apps for the e-commerce merchants and websites and stores. And so, you know, a long history of both working with hands-on with the owners of the e-commerce sites and, you know, helping to plan and optimize those businesses while side-by-side really working as part of a community, because in e-commerce, it takes a village. You know, you need the right solutions for shipping, for sales tax management, for payment processing, for the list goes on and on, for integrating with your other software, with your point of sale in your retail stores, your ERP or accounting suite, your drop shippers, your other online sales channels like Amazon and eBay, where, you know, wherever you're selling online, you need to make sure that your inventory is being properly managed, that your order fulfillment is happening effectively. There's no shortage of solutions that have to come together to really operate efficiently and effectively and scale up in e-commerce. And so I've been really rooted in that community for a long time. You know, I've earned lots of certifications and have been very active in a lot of online communities, as well as authoring just droves of content, for the industry, and I host the JetRails podcast, where we primarily focus on e-commerce related topics. So I stay really active there. And for JetRails, as a company that primarily supports those e-commerce users, it's very similar that we really sit at a crossroads of, you know, if our customers are having an issue, let's say with a payment processor where the payment processor servers, their APIs are failing, well, you know, we're going to get a call saying something is going wrong and the site's not processing right and the client is trying to figure it out, and we're going to be one of those paths of least resistance. And, you know, it's going to behoove us, let's say that that's a major provider, to be on the front lines trying to sort that out and, you know, throw up some red flags and see what we can do, even though it's not necessarily part of our stack or part of our SLA, part of our service agreement, you know, that we need to be part of those solutions. And we see things in the aggregate as web hosts, where we you know, host thousands of websites. And so when there's an issue, we might realize something's going on and be able to identify the scale of the issue a lot faster than one individual user.
Okay, excellent. Now, the e-commerce industry, I remember my first thoughts into that go back to like the mid-90s during the start of the dot-com craze. I remember everybody's trying to get a Sun Microsystems server. Their big tagline was, oh yeah, we're the dot and dot-com. And that's kind of my vision of how e-commerce got started, you know, the NASDAQ going to record highs, you know, and everything. How has e-commerce industry evolved, though, in the recent years, ever since, like, the dot-com bust? Like, going back all the way to 2000, if you can remember that far back, how really has it evolved now to what it is now?
Well, I'll try to give a shorter answer to that, because that's a big question, but I think... And we've seen certainly in the last year and a half or so, as people have been home and distancing more than ever in my lifetime and then some, that we've seen more and more of a move for where shoppers are really open-minded to placing the order online. And so what's really happened is the kind of shift that we've seen where people went from writing checks to paying with, you know, Venmo or, you know, or some Cash App or something else that they, and it often starts with younger generations that, you know, kind of break the ice with a lot of things in a lot of cases. We've gotten to a point where even in sectors like B2B, buyers don't want to wait to go to a trade show or to get a catalog to see the latest and greatest or to get that order in. It's much more dynamic. They're not waiting to go to a showroom in order to make that purchase. They're looking for that online experience to be able to manage that. And it's not necessarily that they don't want to have a sales rep that they can lean on, but they don't want to have to wait to play phone tag with that person and to ask manually over the phone about inventory and availability when it can all be available to them at their fingertips online. And so we've seen really that that kind of experience where even brick and mortar stores have that need of being omnichannel, of being able to let their shoppers know, this is what our inventory is in these local stores, and you can order it for store pickup. It'll be ready within, you know, X time, and you can buy online and return in store and have all of these different experiences that are much more user-friendly. They're much more customer-centric. So that's, for me, a lot of the evolution is that, you know, shoppers have definitely it's not that they don't want to, in a lot of cases, be able to be waited on in person, to be able to deal with experts in person and have that benefit of being able to see and touch and, well, you know, there's something to be said for being able to go in and choose clothing in in real time, where you can actually experience the merchandise, try it on, get something that day that you know is going to be perfect. But there are just as many folks that they don't want to deal with what the stock inventory is at one local store. They'll go to Zappos and they'll order 20 pairs of shoes, figure out which ones fit, send the rest back at no cost to them, and that's a great experience. So different individuals, different shopping patterns, but we've absolutely seen just a major escalation in online shopping, and to the point where, you know, it was Black Friday in-store and Cyber Monday online, and now it's really all just melded together where people aren't, you know, it doesn't even wait for Black Friday anymore. People are already shopping online days before, getting access to these sales. They don't have to be knocking each other over to try to get to something in the store. I think it's a much more civilized experience in that sense. It certainly brings challenges in terms of being able to support the levels of traffic on some of these websites and such, where things have to be done to properly load test and make sure that that everything's going to hold, not just the hardware, not just the server infrastructure, but also all the software and all of the apps and add-ons that are part of that stack, that they have to be able to handle that traffic surge as well. So there's just been a general increase in escalation, and I don't think that we've seen the end of it. We certainly saw a major jump in the last couple of years, and so there might be a little plateau from there as things catch up, but you know how things go. It's just like how we're talking about people working from home, that once a lot of people start doing it, some of them will go back to in office and some won't. Or there'll be more of a hybrid model where, you know, maybe they spend 2 days at home and 3 days in person or those sorts of things. And I think that that's really what we're seeing with e-commerce. It's not that people don't want to be able to go to the supermarket and pick fruit and vegetables and other fresh goods in person, but there's also a time when it's just easier to place an order for a few items and go do curbside pickup and not have to get caught up in the whole store for an hour or, you know, deal with delivery, that sort of thing. So the same reason that for years and years we might have called in a pizza order and had it delivered, I think that this is the next logical step that we're seeing for a lot of industries, and a lot of industries that might have lagged in e-commerce have really propelled forward.
Okay, excellent. Now, the next big topic is going to be, you know, cyber attacks, cyber crimes. You know, e-commerce stores, e-commerce platforms, they've always been a prime target, but ever since COVID-19 hit, they've become even more of a target. And I've written, I wouldn't say like a good deal, but I've written a fair amount about e-commerce security and like where the vulnerabilities and the threats are. And what I'm finding is not so much that the platform is not secure. It's just that if it's a custom-created online store, I think a lot of the weaknesses lie in the insecure source code and the APIs that are being used. A lot of software developers, they use, you know, open-source API libraries which are not tested or updated or so forth. One big thing right now that I'm seeing is e-skimming, and I think the one big thing that's kind of it gets kind of confused at the point of sale on purchases, but here with e-skimming, it's that you think, okay, suppose you go to Amazon.com, you buy a book, you submit your credit card, you got your email confirmations, your book comes, you think all secure, but all of a sudden your credit card can still get hijacked, and that's what e-skimming is about. Now, what are other cyber crimes have you seen or have you helped clients with in this e-commerce front?
Sure. So there, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. it is a challenge, and it stems from a few areas. And so there are things in recent years, you know, just a few years ago, credit card processing updated to the point where in person, you're more likely to be using a chip than swiping the card, and you know, having cards, you know, chipped has improved you know, some of the cybercrime statistics for in person. However, it's still easy to type in the credit card number. You don't need a chip for that on a website, and so, you know, a lot of those traditional, you know, criminal enterprises that were dealing in stolen credit cards and trying to leverage those where they might have cloned the cards, tried to use them in person somewhere. Well, now online is certainly the best bet in many, many, many cases. So there's there's no shortage of attempts on that side. And so one of the things that we've noticed a little bit of an uptick in are carding attacks, where thieves, you know, cyber criminals are hitting a payment gateway with tons and tons of credit card numbers, trying to figure out which numbers are still active, which they can actually still make purchases with. And so there are these sorts of things that you do see some patterns. They're not necessarily completely new, but as with everything in security, there's always a new challenge. One of the bigger issues that I see in the market, you know, when it comes to credit card fraud, which is certainly the number one issue that I think about when it comes to e-commerce, you know, security in general, you have PCI compliance. You have the payment card industry's standards, the PCI DSS, which are meant to basically set bare minimum security standards if you're going to accept credit cards. That includes if you're going to accept them in person. You know, it sets the rules that try to make sure that wherever you're swiping or inserting your card, that is a safe device. It's the same thing online, that it sets all the standards for what someone, what a business needs to be doing if they're going to accept credit cards online. I think that a big challenge is that the SMB market doesn't focus very well on that. It's very exciting to spend money on marketing. It's very interesting to spend money on new features and things that'll delight shoppers. That's fantastic. That's exciting. Security is like insurance. You know, it's something that you get to protect yourself, but it's not something that you get to double up your business to see specific return on investment. So it's a challenge. So we wind up seeing a lot of users that aren't up to date in security patches. So according to PCI regulations, you're supposed to patch within 30 days. Even that might be a little longer in some cases than would be ideal. We see a lot of folks that, you know, that come to us that have had a security incident that are looking for our hosting because we include a lot of extra security, but they haven't been upkeeping the patches of their software, whether that's Magento or WordPress or Drupal or whatever platform. That's very important. We also see a lot of folks that they either don't have or don't properly configure their web application firewalls and other solutions, or they're not monitoring their intrusion detection systems or other solutions and malware scanners and things that they have. So, you know, I always think of security as proactive and reactive, that just like in a physical space, you lock doors, you put up fences and other things in order to keep criminals out, and you have maybe security guards or camera systems or other things to keep an eye out, or alarm systems in case they sneak in. You have to have your different security solutions in play, but, you know, if you have cameras and they're not recording and no one's looking at them, they don't do you very much. It's not going to help very much. So we wind up seeing things like websites where they're, you know, if you own a website and you are able to log in, it has a content management system of some sort, you have an admin page, a back end where you can log in and update the website, there's no reason that someone that doesn't work for you or with you should be able to access that. You know, the whole world doesn't need to be able to go to that URL, to that web address, and try to break their way in. And basic firewalling, you know, should be part of that. There's what's known in the industry as least privileged access. Resources should only be available to people that really need to access them. The front of the website needs to be accessible to the masses, but the back, not so much. So we see a lot of open doors like that where it's just not following best practice. There's not a lot of thought into it, and that's a big challenge. When you get up into the large organizations, typically they're at the point of having a security assessor for PCI and whatever other regulations they're beholden to. And we see that happening a little bit less. But what's interesting is that we see similar problems happening. So, you know, a lot of those issues that I was just talking about have to do with the open source world, where you're responsible for your patching. you're responsible for the upkeep of your website, the hosting and basic security of your website. The same thing applies, though, to businesses that go with a SaaS solution, a software as a service solution that's already hosted in the cloud or wherever it is. And so there are lots of companies that do that these days, like Shopify and BigCommerce and such. And I think that it creates very much a false sense of security for merchants that at that point they think that all security is managed for them and there's no risk and they don't really pay much attention to it. And what winds up happening is they, in order to use a basic platform like that that's not as robust as something like Magento, you use a lot of apps, use a lot of third-party solutions, and there's not generally very much thought at all about who you're giving access to and what their security protocols are like. And next thing you know, you've given access to companies all over the world. They get access to your sensitive data like customer data. They get access to add, you know, or there's JavaScript encoding added to your website, which can be hijacked if that third-party company is compromised. And so we see a lot of these paradigm shifts in the market where, as I said a few minutes ago, you know, the more the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's really about these merchants doing their due diligence. And I think, you know, one of the updates that we're seeing that's coming out, and it's still rather early, has to do with privacy security, where now not only are you responsible for credit card data, but as you grow and as you service different markets, such as in California or the EU in Europe or Brazil, or, you know, there are other laws coming out for places like Virginia, you're responsible for keeping people's data private. And if you your site is compromised, there are teeth to some of these laws where whether it's, you know, fines and penalties or whether you open yourself to civil lawsuits and things, there are repercussions. But we're not seeing a lot of businesses yet really pay attention to, is this level of security going to protect me when it comes to GDPR, the EU regulations, or CCPA, the California Privacy Act, or things of that nature. So I think that we'll see maybe some more focus on some of it as we go, but it's like a lot of things in life that, you know, as far as what we're seeing in security, you're absolutely right that there are those that are doing a great job of just, you know, if there's a new security patch, they install it. There's a best practice, they follow it. And by and large, they stay secure. It's very rare that someone that follows those basic kinds of principles is going to have an issue. It's the ones that basically look at it as if, well, I'm a merchant. I sell things. I'm not really a technologist, and I don't have a security officer, and so I'm just going to hope for the best. And hoping for the best is not a security plan. So that's absolutely the case, but we see this day in and day out that, and it's not even just the web software itself, which includes, you know, not just e-commerce, but informational and other websites, lots of sites out there that aren't up to date, but the hosting environments aren't up to date. They're running old versions of Linux, old versions of PHP. They're not properly patching the hosting environment and upkeeping that. And, you know, aside from locking it down properly and firewalling properly and all the, you know, the things that should be done alongside of it, they're not keeping the base software properly maintained. And so, you know, what you would expect happens over time happens. They get hacked, and, you know, usually after that point, they're a lot more cognizant. But I think that it's so easy for businesses today to overlook a lot of those things and to wait for a problem rather than be proactive. And that's the bigger challenge in the market. And I think that in a lot of ways, the scarier part for me is that it turns off shoppers when their credit card data or other data is compromised. And, you know, fraudsters have their information and, you know, they're seeing these bad charges on their card. They have to have those wiped out. They have to get a new credit card, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whatever's happening there, they may think twice before purchasing from a new brand or someone they don't know well, where maybe they'll trust Amazon, right? You know, that's a little easier for them. But it can do damage to consumer sentiment. And so that's something that I'm always worried about is that, you know, can't we all just do the right thing when it comes to security and get out in front of it?
Okay. Now, you brought this important issue of data privacy. As you said, that's credit card information, but now we're dealing like with other forms of PII data sets. Now, how has the legislations of the GDPR, CCPA, PCI DSS, have they had any impact on people being more proactive and securing their stores, given the threats of audits and really some very harsh penalties, financial penalties?
I wish I could tell you that it was a regular conversation that came up with developers and clients where they were asking about those regulations and things. You know, as web hosts that maintain backups for people, so when you talk about PII, the personal identifying information, well, just deleting it from the live copies of data isn't enough. You have to have a plan for eventually getting rid of it in terms of getting rid of backups. Now, in most cases, you can simply have a plan that states that that data will live on for an amount of time before it's ultimately removed because, you know, you're going to keep your backups for a while. But, you know, you think that would come up in some of these conversations a little bit more than it does. But we haven't really hit that tipping point with it yet. And I think it's partly because it's so piecemeal. A lot of these regulations are focused on large organizations. A lot of these regulations, are focused on specific areas where, look, you know, if I'm a domestic seller of sporting goods and I don't ship to Europe, well, GDPR isn't going to come into my life all that much. And, you know, I think that as more places enact these laws and we see more of that common thread of, okay, well, everyone's expecting me to keep this baseline minimum of security, or I'm facing these repercussions, it might start to kick in more. But, you know, for us to find a small or medium American or Canadian or whatever business that's been fined or that's been sued over these regulations so far, I suspect that there aren't that many. I see more people talking about things like accessibility, the ability of people to be able to navigate the website if they're visually or auditorily or otherwise impaired and have, you know, vision or hearing or other cognitive issues. And so because there are more legal letters going out, you know, threatening lawsuits and things against organizations that have websites that aren't following best practices when it comes to compliance for folks with disabilities, that gets more attention. And I think it just isn't the fact when I hear people talk about data privacy, they're usually talking about things like the right to be forgotten and, you know, the ability for people to request that their information be removed, things like that. Not so much how do we make sure that we don't have a security breach that puts us in conflict with these new data privacy laws. Now, when you talk about large enterprises, there's security officers. It's a different conversation being had. But when we're talking about most of the market, it just really hasn't made it there yet.
Okay. Now, let's see here. Now, what kind of preventative measures do you see having a major impact? I know another big buzzword that's being banged about here in cybersecurity is the zero trust framework, where you literally cannot trust anybody inside or outside. Do you see any e-commerce platforms that you're hosting adopt this kind of framework, or what other preventative measurements are they taking, like the 2FA or MFA? Can you expand a little bit more on that?
So we are seeing more two-factor authentication, more 2FA across the board with platforms like Magento and SaaS platforms like BigCommerce as well, that it's becoming more common practice. There are a variety of other things that we're seeing become a little bit more common. But I think that one of the biggest challenge perhaps is that e-commerce is, and the web in general, fields that are constantly changing. You know, so websites now are being built in with different front-end languages and technologies like progressive web apps, PWA solutions. Every, and the amount of time certainly varies, but there's always something new. So if you're a growing e-commerce merchant, you're going to be looking for what's that new app or extension that I can add to my website that's going to improve my conversion rate, my rate of turning website visitors into customers that have placed an order. What can I do to increase my average order value? What can I do to increase my customer lifetime value? How can I combine my data so that my marketing systems know about, these things happening over here that could impact, or that could be leveraged to drive more sales. So, if we know that the customer made this purchase at this date in the e-commerce system for this product, maybe they should get an email 30 days later from one of the marketing solutions saying, hey, maybe, this is a replenishable item. It's time to reorder. Things like that everything really starts to come together. And because these stacks are constantly changing and growing, it's very hard to stick to the minimum. What I think needs to happen more is to look at these apps and add-ons a little bit more holistically. I've been saying for a while now, it's very new age, but we have to be able to look at things and say, in the same way that we might with items in our home, does this bring me joy? Does this bring me, do I need this in my house? I think we have to be able to say the same thing with software. Does this bring me value? Is this, and that's not just thinking about it as a test where I think that this is going to bring me value and so let's test it out. But it's also coming back around and, okay, we used this solution 2 years ago. Is this still a viable part of our tech stack? Is it redundant? Who still has access to it? Are we making sure that, that former employees or former vendors are locked out successfully at set intervals? Things that need to be happening often just get – things happen so fast in e-commerce and in technology in general that I find that a lot of that gets left behind. And so we're – so we talk, in security about, as you were suggesting, really locking things down to the bare minimums. This is an industry that has a hard time with that, and for good reason. And so it's a bit of the opposite. I think in a lot of cases, it's about pruning. It's about spring cleaning. It's about taking more time. And I'll say it's not just security. So one of the common threads that we see is also that folks add apps and add-ons and things that slow down their websites. And when they're choosing them, they think about the cost of the add-on. They think about the return on investment. They think about, the feature sets and their ability to grow within all sorts of things. It's very rare that they actually stop and think about how much latency is that going to add. Is this add-on going to make my web page 2 seconds slower? And I could go with something else that would only add, a tenth of a second of extra load time. And so there are these secondary decision-making factors that a lot of folks just don't put a lot of focus on while they're making their choices. And I think that we see a lot of that. So security, it takes a back seat where e-commerce managers and marketers and merchandisers and others in the e-commerce world might play a bigger role in deciding what the company is going to invest into for their online store, what technology is going to be added, what's going to happen. And there's not often nearly as much focus on the security or speed or some of these other factors.
Okay.
Scalability.
No. kind of I get asked, and I even ask myself, is, okay, we have so much security. You know, there's so many tools out there. There are things that people can do with it. And there's help out there. It's not that there's no one that can help these e-commerce merchants. I mean, there are MSPs, people like yourself, SSPs, other cyber consultants. But why are they still being hacked so much? Is it just because we live in such a reactive society that we just have a knee-jerk reaction and we just don't want to be proactive until we're hit because we have the mindset, well, we're not going to get hit? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that we are in there really is a history here of being reactionary. And so I was sitting, I'm going to say maybe a little over a year ago, in a YouTube live stream session, and it was talking about PCI compliance around the end of life of an e-commerce platform. And there was the head of another hosting company that was in the chat talking about how merchants in their hosting environments get hacked all the time and no one ever gets fined over the PCI compliance implications. And that kind of attitude, I think, can be a bit pervasive in this space, that there's not a lot of fear of having a security incident there. You know, when you go to an agency to say, hey, look, I'm looking to build a new website or to grow my website, it's not often that their team is going to sit down and do a risk analysis with you and say, look, here are ways that you should be reinvesting into your business. And, you know, these are just minimum base level. You've got to do this or we really shouldn't be working together. There are lots of folks that will say, look, you know, we'll build it for you. If you don't want to patch it, that's on you. You know, we'll add these extensions for you, or we'll provide these new designs for you. You don't want to patch for security? Okay, that's your choice. And they don't really push back a lot when they're the industry experts. So those are the sorts of situations that I run into a lot where I think that I was talking with a merchant just a few days ago, and I recognized that they were missing security patches and they didn't have admin resources properly firewalled. And so I alerted them to that and said, look, you know, you don't necessarily have to switch web hosts, but, you know, to come on board with JetRails over those things, you could deal with those things where you're at. But you should be aware that this is happening. And they said, oh, but we paid for, you know, for the firewall. We paid an agency to do the patching. Well, maybe they did it in a development copy of your site, but it doesn't look like these things have been rolled out to the live website yet. You know, maybe you're paying for firewalling, but it's not configured. No one's gone in and done what needs to be done with it. So there's a lot of hand washing of, you know, I'm going to wash my hands of this. I paid somebody, or I didn't. Where there's not enough ownership of these situations in terms of being able to really say, look, you know, I'm responsible for this as the business owner, and I'm going to make sure that I do this well because it's important for my customers, my employees, my business, that I not suffer a breach and I not suffer the myriad of consequences that can come along with that. And that's, I don't think that it's a lack of tools. I don't think it's a lack of options. And we actually find that JetRails, it's one of our biggest selling points, that you don't need to go and manage all these things yourself, the web application firewall, the intrusion detection systems, the malware scanners, the, you know, the locking things down for PCI compliance and other compliances. We will help you with that. You know, we will address that for you. That's not what you're going to find with most, just about any web hosting that you're going to come across. And I think that that's where things get lost. When you're expecting a company that operates, you know, during normal business hours to be able to monitor 24/7, when you're expecting a team that doesn't have security officers, you know, sysadmins, sysops people, that sort of thing, to be able to have the right expertise in these things, they need a trusted advisor. They need someone that's going to be able to deal with things in real time. That's what's usually missing from the puzzle. And I don't see it changing terribly, but hopefully we continue to see it evolve.
Okay, excellent. Now, another thing I want to ask you about is the crypto jacking. I mean, that's kind of where the cyber attacker taps into a device to use your processing electrical power to legally mine for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. And they're just not stopping at dedicated devices. They're actually not penetrating into the cloud. Have you had any instances of that where your clients have been hit with crypto jacking?
You know, I stay on top of really, you know, we luckily because we're extremely proactive, we don't see a lot of security incidents. I can't, I'm aware of the increase in crypto jacking that's out there. We have not experienced very much, if any of it, which, you know, I'm happy to say. I think that, you know, we're lucky in a lot of ways, but, you know, luck doesn't always come from nowhere. There's a lot of, you know, I work with a team of people that's really dedicated to avoiding things like that. But from my standpoint, why the person is trying to hack the website or the hosting environment, while it's important, it's extremely important to understand it and to that helps in terms of proper planning and addressing of different situations. Look, they could have been trying to hack the environment to send out spam emails. They could have been doing it as a staging point to put up spam content or, you know, to try to get people to download some form of malware onto their own machines or, you know, their own PCs or devices or what have you. That, you know, we, because we deal with a lot of e-commerce users, if we're going to see something, it's more likely someone trying to steal credit card data. But these are the sort of, you know, to me, the issues, you know, that drive the hackers or cyber criminals, whatever you want to call them, to break into these environments is probably less important than the fact that someone's going to be trying to break in. And if you leave glaring security holes, they're basically scanning the web and they're looking for sites that are built on all these popular platforms. And if your site isn't properly patched or properly secured, you're a sitting duck, you're a target. And, you know, it's interesting that, and I have through the years spoken with many people that would say something to me to the extent of, but I'm just a small, you know, local retailer of, I don't know, you know, shoes or something. And I have this little website, you know, that sells, you know, a few pair a week or something. Why would anybody target me? Well, they don't. It's the same with cryptojacking. They don't really care about who you are or what you're selling or what your website is. They're just looking for a vulnerable environment that they can take advantage of and use for whatever their purposes are. And if you have one, great. You know, so it's really, I think, really important for the community to consistently remember that you know, there's always going to be a new reason and another reason to leverage these environments to for hackers to be trying to penetrate them and take advantage of vulnerabilities. So it's really just, you know, other than when we're talking about zero-day events where there's a vulnerability that isn't patched yet, that there is no solve for yet because it hasn't been identified yet, which is much more rare. You know, I mean, that's certainly how some hacks are identified in the first place because someone has broken through security and it's identified and then, you know, then addressed retroactively. But in general, you know, for me, it's just about being proactive because at that point, it doesn't really matter why they're trying to get in. You've made it so hard for them to get in, and you've set, you know, things like the intrusion detection and malware scanning and other things that is likely to catch them if they have made their way in. And so, you know, it's like the alarm going off after, you know, when the motion sensor goes off. Well, hopefully that chases them off, and you get to lock things back down before they could do major damage, before they could steal a lot of data or, you know, hijack customers somewhere else or other things that, to me, that's the focal point. That's what I think everyone needs to continue to focus on as heavily as possible. It's is proactive security as opposed to what they're after.
Okay. Now, the other two topics I want to talk about are artificial intelligence and the IoT. I know that Azure and AWS, they have a lot of product offerings they offer to their clients as they build up their VMs, their VPs. Now, if this question is too far-fetched, just let me know, but is JetRails going to offer something along the AI realm or IoT realm for their clients, especially when it comes to, like, plugging in new devices for their clients to access online stores or really to help, like, your bigger clients, like, harness that big data and find the unhidden trends and so forth. Do you guys make use of that already, or is something you're going to maybe offer down the road to your clients, or...?
It's an interesting question. So I think in some ways we're a little early, and I'll say I oversee facets of our partnership with AWS. And, you know, every time I turn around, there's new tools and new solutions, and they're certainly at the forefront of cloud computing in so many ways. And so, you know, we certainly, as a web hosting provider, have certain, as a managed service provider, fit certain niches and really service certain customers. And, you know, as we see things like e-commerce, we do run into users that have need of, back to something I said earlier, progressive web apps. One of the great use cases for a PWA front end is being able to design different user interfaces that you might use in kiosks or other devices in more of an Internet of Things, more of an IoT realm. So you're not limited to just having your storefront designed and functional in a way that's going to be comfortable from a, you know, from a PC, a desktop or laptop, or from a mobile device, a smartphone or tablet, but also, you know, unique experiences that would be specific to some of those other types of devices and experiences. So we are seeing some of that, and in some cases we have to do things a little differently for that. So some of, depending on what tech stack they're using, the hosting stack needs to match, that some of that needs to live in the edge. It's quote-unquote serverless, which I think is a terrible term because there's servers that are powering all of it, but it's stuff that's sitting outside of your traditional, what used to be a LAMP stack, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP kind of stack, that sort of thing, that it's going to be much more code-driven. And that's all well and good, and it's important that teams like ours that really are more white glove, that tailor around the needs of the users that we support, are going to be able to deal with those kinds of evolutions and those kinds of specific one-off needs on a case-by-case, because there's lots of different technologies at play here, and we're yet to see what the winners are going to be in that PWA space or some of these other related spaces. So that's a piece of it. For us, if someone writes a completely custom application, a custom SaaS application they want to run as a tech company, we can help them host it and provide the resources that they need. Some people come to us just because they realize that they're overpaying for AWS or for their hosting in general, and they need a team that's going to come in and rather than throw more CPU, more web nodes, more hardware at something, that's going to come in and really optimize with the right caching and the right load balancing and the right things that are going to be advantageous in the long run, thinking smarter, not harder about it. So there are times when people come to us for different reasons. Security is a major one. Speed is a major issue that comes up. Flexibility, where they've outgrown a web hosting environment where they can't get the unique configurations, the unique optimization around their software and their needs, comes up more and more often as we see people really need to be innovative and not be able to do it with a more traditional web hosting environment. And we see it with scalability where this last year and a half, there are businesses where every day was like Black Friday and they just really needed to have that reliability. And then when the holiday shopping season came, it was beyond anything they'd ever experienced. And so that knowledge of knowing that they're in good shape with those situations, that they can handle the traffic surges and spikes and what have you, all these things are important. And kind of like I always talk about security, that it's not always about what the attack is. For us, what we host in the environment, you know, whether that's, let's say, in e-commerce, whether that's Magento or WooCommerce or Shopware or, you know, or some other platform, PrestaShop, or, you know, I could keep listing them, Xcard. There's lots of them. We see more Magento than anything. We've got a lot of experience there. But we're starting to see more interest in other platforms like Shopware that comes out of Germany and is very popular out in certain parts of Europe and you know, is starting to you know, break ground a little bit more on this side of the Atlantic. You know, that the same applies to different tools and situations that will come in and will help engineer solutions around someone's unique needs. And we love doing that with different AWS tools. But, you know, it's funny that you see something like message queuing services. So Amazon has their own. But you go to a platform like Magento, which now natively integrates with RabbitMQ, which, you know, is a third party, part of the VMware family now. And we'll wind up with customers that are using both side by side, the VMware, you know, the RabbitMQ product and the product from Amazon, from AWS. And for us, it's really about, you know, this thing integrates natively and does what it needs, but for these other solutions, this integrates, you know, natively or this is more advantageous. For us, it's really all about what's going to work best. It's the same way that when it comes to the actual hosting environment, our go-to CDN and WAF is going to come from Cloudflare, and that's been a major partnership of ours for years and years. But if someone comes to us with a good use case for another solution provider, we have other partners, and we're open-minded to working with others. If that's what's going to do the best job for them, what they're most comfortable and experienced with, or what has the exact feature set that they need, we're here to help get to the solution, not the opposite. So how much of that is going to come in with AI and other solutions? You know, in e-commerce, we're seeing more and more AI as it relates to, you know, what products shoppers are being shown and what offers they're being shown and what marketing is being sent to them. And, you know, we're seeing more AI in the security stack as it relates to some of the firewalling and other issues and you know, especially when it comes to things like identifying bots and blocking the bad ones, where solutions can sometimes do a better, faster job of dealing with these situations than human beings can, of course. And so there are times when these things are coming into the stack. But I think for the foreseeable future, our real core focus is going to continue to be around people that have an application that's Linux-based, that they need assistance with hosting, and that we can really shine for them and be their trusted partner, the extension of their in-house team or their agency that they've hired that's going to handle that hosting side of things from soup to nuts.
Okay. One last thing on the issues front of cybersecurity. We're seeing obviously a huge, huge uptick in ransomware, you know, like with the Colonial Oil gas pipeline and that one meat processor being hit. Cybersecurity insurance is now starting to really come up to the forefront now. In fact, there are a lot of companies now that are starting to take a second look as to what their payout's going to be. Even that French company, AXA, they said we're not going to pay any more payouts for, you know, if you're going to pay the ransom for an attack. Have you had clients ask you about cybersecurity insurance on the off chance as they get their e-commerce platforms up and running with you guys? Or
so I'm familiar with various providers of cyber security insurance and have done some good research in the space through the years. It is not a topic that a lot of small and medium merchants really spend a lot of time looking at. I think, again, you know, when you're up into the enterprises and there's a lot on the line, that's a little bit different than, you know, they spend more time evaluating their risks and solutions around that. But for better or worse, I don't think that it comes up as often as it should. It is something that we're happy to talk to clients about and help make sure that they have what they need and that they're in a good position. Again, you know, hiring us in a lot of ways, I think that a lot of them look at as part of that insurance policy, not that it's going to pay out, but that it's going to reduce the risk for them in general. It's a challenge, and we don't see, sort of like the cryptojacking, we don't see as much of the ransomware. I have seen some of it, not necessarily from clients as much as from prospects, from prospective clients. Because we have standards of keeping off-server backups and other things, harder for folks to impact our clients in quite that same way, where they can hold things for ransom. And, you know, in a lot of cases, our clients are using development pipelines, things like GitHub, where there's version control software. And so a lot of the coding really living elsewhere anyway and can be redeployed pretty easily. Database information that, you know, certainly, you know, is usually going to be more up to our backups than anything. But there's the overall, you know, challenge that we're seeing in the market. I think, again, back to whether it's ransomware, cryptojacking, or this or that, is that especially out of foreign countries, you know, some particular ones seem to, you know, be at the heart of a lot of the issues that we're seeing, as best as it's reported, that there's an increase. I read an article recently that, and not the first time I've seen it, but that was talking about kind of like back in the days of the Pirates of the Caribbean style piracy, where governments would issue directives that corporations, that companies, like shipping companies, you know, could basically go to war with pirates. That I almost wonder if we're going to get to that point where if government can't stop these things on its own, if we're really going to see an even bigger partnership with private enterprise to defend itself. Now, I think that just the overall increase in cybercrime activity, and in a way that, look, the reason that a lot of cyber theft that I've, you know, read about and studied through the years, through recent years, has happened was because it was easy and because there wasn't a lot of risk or penalty. And so when you see whether it's filing false claims on tax returns, you know, or on and when I say false claims, I mean, you know, filing using someone else's name, social security number, that sort of thing, in order to create a fictitious return and you know, steal a refund from the government, something like that, or, you know, unemployment insurance, you know, so get someone's unemployment monies, or for someone that's working, just, you know, to file under their name. That people do these things, the same reason, you know, that in some cases when it comes to credit card fraud, that they're making small purchases with these credit cards or debit cards that they're stealing. They know that by the time that any individual policing authority catches up with them over, you know, a couple of hundred dollars here, a couple of hundred dollars there, it's going to take a while for anyone to really be willing to build a case around it. That in some cases, you know, there's this challenge of there's just not a centralized enough approach to handling this, to identifying what's happening and to stopping it. So we're playing a bigger and bigger game of defense in a lot of ways. And the same with scam call centers that, you know, if you've got a phone, you're probably getting a lot more robocalls, you know, to deal with those sorts of things. That it's just common. And the reason is because they can open a call center cheaply, especially in other countries, you know, and it's not specifically to me always about what the country is, but there's not a lot out there to stop this. And so while we know that government is responding sometimes quietly in ways that we don't see, and we know that, you know, that the FBI and other organizations are there tracking certain things, and the FCC, and you know, all sorts of things are happening, but it just feels like we have not done enough to be proactive in how we respond to these issues. And so there's just not a big impetus to folks that feel like this is a good opportunity for them to make money, that it's easy money. So that's for me. You know, I don't think that any of this is going away quickly. I think that we'll play a game of whack-a-mole where, you know, we'll find some different tech solutions to block certain things, to improve certain things, but the next is going to arise, because basically in my head, I go back to, like, you know, mafia films. And okay, well, so if the gambling gets shut down, you know, we'll get into, you know, there's racketeering over here. There's something else that arises. And so if the criminal organizations are still there looking for the next thing, they're going to find the next thing. We aren't doing the best job globally of putting these things out of commission, of locking these things down quickly and effectively. And so we just continue to have to play defense. And it does put a lot of strain, I think, on individual businesses and organizations that are up against this sort of thing.
Well, finally, Robert, as we wrap up our show here, how do you think the e-commerce front's going to take shape here now for the rest of the year, maybe going into 2022? I mean, now we're seeing COVID kind of easing up, you know, with people getting vaccinated and things starting to open up now. How's this all going to kind of unfold here in the next remaining months and going into early next year?
You know, I think that we're going to see some increases in some sectors. So in March of last year, when everything started to lock down, there were immediately some industries that were just selling whatever they had, like hotcakes. I mean, imagine if you had exercise equipment or webcams to sell. Everybody wanted it. They were all stuck home. Easy to sell, let alone personal protective equipment or toilet paper or whatever it could have been. And lots of things that related to hobbies or home offices or just nesting at home, because you're spending so much time at home, that there are verticals and industries that did really well in e-commerce. There are other industries that initially suffered, like, you know, clothing and apparel, where sales weren't so great. And depending on what you were selling, that might have remained pretty sluggish. So if you were selling, you know, dress clothes, you know, formal wear, well, people weren't going to a lot of formal events. And so there are some that I think we're going to see certainly shoot up, where demand is going to rise as everybody's back out there. And in some cases, it already is rising. And, you know, it's already happening. And on the flip side, we're going to see some numbers will plateau, if not even perhaps decline a little bit. And we may already, you know, in some of the data that I've seen, be seeing some of those trends. So, you know, maybe fewer people using Instacart to get their groceries because they're more comfortable to go in person a little bit more often or what have you. But overall, the data that I'm seeing isn't showing a complete reversion to pre 2020 or anything like that. So people that are now have a subscription to Instacart, or that are used to curbside pickup somewhere, or that are used to ordering certain goods online, that have gotten comfortable with it, well, you know, it's like anything else. It's patterned on them now, that the norm has changed. So I don't think that we're going to go completely backwards. And because e-commerce has been on a steady incline for, you know, as long as it's been around, I think that while there may be some leveling out effect in the short term, I think it's really a safe sector overall. I do think that there are maybe a few bubbles within it. Things like, you know, there are platforms like Shopify that have really made it exciting to launch, you know, drop shipping stores where you don't have any goods. You just create a website, you know, create a brand for it, and start to push it out there in the world, hoping to sell other people's goods that will be shipped on demand from whatever distributor or whatever the drop shipping company is. And, I've begun to really look at that like almost like a multi-level marketing scheme where it's enticing to be, to have this side hustle, to have your own business, to have your own e-commerce website and be able to sell things. But how many people really have the network or the marketing plan to really be successful in offering the same goods as everyone else at the same prices, if not worse prices? Because, you're not really, when you buy goods and you hold on to them, usually you get a better price break than when you're just drop shipping it when you're taking no risk. It's more like consignment. So it's, we may see some things ebb and flow as with everything in the world. I think that some people went from trying to be involved with things like Avon and Amway to setting up these drop shipping stores. We'll see with some of it, but I think that overall the e-commerce sector is extremely healthy, extremely stable. I think it's absolutely going to only continue to innovate and to really take over more of the marketplace. And, I don't think that all of the malls that have suffered are going to come back in full force. There are some that are going to do quite well in certain areas with certain clientele and anchors and things, but a lot of them are going to be converted into distribution centers for e-commerce and into other types of resources. That I think that it's only going to get harder for some of that, and especially considering the competition that's out there. In a lot of cases. The last year and a half has pushed businesses further with trend lines that were already there, things like mall stores that were already, in many cases, overextended and in bad shape. I think that, that's a real trend and that we'll continue to see businesses moving online, staying online. In many cases, we see online retailers opening up small showrooms where you can experience some of the products, something like, Warby Parker, where you can, maybe check out some of the eyeglass frames in store. But it's really all about the online experience. And so I think that we may see more of that where e-commerce continues to figure out what kind of experiences they need to have in the physical world, in brick and mortar. But, there's so many trend lines here where with Walmart and Target and these big box stores, Costco, and, I was talking about in a recent podcast episode, when it comes to toy stores, if you think, KB Toys, Toys R Us, you could buy toys at Barnes & Noble. Toys R Us became more of a commodity place. It wasn't an experiential place. I think of places like GameStop, at least, of having all these release events and other things where they tried to make it more of a destination. But I think for a lot of shoppers, they are looking for convenience. Time is stretched more than ever. Time is our most important commodity. And e-commerce really leans into that, really gives shoppers what they're looking for, a fast, clean experience. And e-commerce sellers will continue to innovate to make the post-purchase experience better, to make the order fulfillment experience better. Everyone's always looking to keep up with whatever Amazon and the other big companies create, but they're also figuring out how to bring some of that in-store experience to people virtually through the internet. They're figuring out how to be better at what they do, how to build a better mousetrap, and how to not be Amazon, how to not be a huge behemoth, but how to be experts in a particular vertical, how to bring that expertise forward to shoppers, and again, really be more of a destination online. And so I think all that will just continue forward as it has. And, I feel lucky to be in an industry that I can feel so good about in terms of its future and its longevity.
Okay, excellent. Now, finally, Robert, if there's somebody who's listening to this podcast or will download it later, What is the best way for them to contact you if they're interested in your services?
JetRails.com. We're at JetRails on all the major social media platforms, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, great ways to track us down. So, you know, always happy to hear from, you know, from folks that have questions, even if it's not specifically about hiring us right now. But if something in this particular podcast struck someone in a way that they think is insightful, I'm Robert Rand. I'm easy to find on LinkedIn, and you can always email me at robert.r@jetrails.com.
Okay. Well, Robert, we thank you for your time this afternoon, and have a wonderful weekend. We look forward to having you on a future podcast.
Absolutely. I really appreciate you having me on today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Take care.